Welcome in to This Week in Bitcoin, episode 107. My name is Chris, chrislas.com, jupiterbroadcasting.com. Well, I can see clearly now. The rain is gone. Take a moment and picture what the economy just might look like if there was no AI pump. Using the recently revised Q1 GDP number for the U.S., AI investment wasn't just a contributor. It was the entire story. Roughly 84% of Q1 GDP growth came from AI-related investments. So AI stocks and things related to AI, hardware, data centers, things like that. So when people say the economy's holding up, I think the real question is it the economy holding up, or is it the giant AI CapEx cycle that is skewing the scoreboard, if you will? And I think what we're seeing with Bitcoin is it's the first major market that is pricing the economy without AI distortion. So stocks, we know they're getting pushed higher by the historic AI bubble. I covered that last week, so we'll go quickly through that. It seems to me that Bitcoin's been reflecting a weaker economy that's hiding below all of this. And we all know that this takes time to play out, but I think this summer could very well mark the transition to this AI bubble endgame.
As SpaceX and OpenAI race toward what could become the biggest IPO showdown in history, not just Wall Street, anywhere, everywhere. Reports say OpenAI could file for a blockbuster IPO as soon as tomorrow. The goal would be to go public as early as September. Elon Musk may already have the upper hand. SpaceX reportedly targeting an $80 billion raise, a valuation north of $1.5 trillion. Investors are now forced to pick sides in this high-stakes fight for bragging rights and the future of AI.
All right, so let's just sort of set the table here and look at some numbers. The valuations for the IPOs for these companies, the numbers are so huge, I think we're kind of losing touch with reality. SpaceX plans to come in around $1.7 trillion. I'm going to do the low numbers, by the way. OpenAI around 850, maybe $900 billion. Anthropic, $900 billion, somewhere around there. These would be the largest U.S. IPOs by valuation ever. To put it in perspective, the largest in the past was Alibaba at $169.4 billion. Meta at $81 billion. So the smallest one on here, OpenAI or Anthropic, depending on the way they land, is still massively larger. Even on the low end, an OpenAI or Anthropic valuation would be a totally different league than something like what was considered a mega IPO in the past, like Meta. For example, OpenAI or Anthropic, they could be 12 times the size of Meta's IPO valuation, 6 times the size of Alibaba's U.S. IPO valuation. So to say markets have never seen an event like this cannot be overstated. Markets, not just the U.S. market, markets have never seen an IPO liquidity event at the scale of these three companies. And I suspect it's not going to be a good thing. There is going to be a real cost. Now, I've heard people say, well, it'll be like the dot-com bust. You know, there was a lot of dark fiber laid and we had a few winners stand out. Okay, well, let's think about that. Oh, I've also heard it compared to the railroads, too. Let's think about that for a second. You know, the railroad companies, there was this big boom. They went bust, but they laid tracks. Okay, so we got dark fiber, we got tracks. You know, we got some analogies here. Well, when a railroad company built tracks in the 19th century, those tracks could be used for 50 years. When an AI company builds a data center, the building is good, but the chips inside, the expensive stuff, the NVIDIA chips inside, for a competitive frontier AI lab, they become obsolete in 3 to 5 years. Now, you know, folks are going to scoop those up on the used market. But for OpenAI and Anthropic and xAI, they don't just get to simply pay off the debt they have and then just chill. They have to essentially generate enough profits to effectively buy their entire hardware stack every 36 to 48 months just to stay competitive. That's a totally different kind of infrastructure business than the dark fiber or the railroad tracks. They're not comparable there. We also know that there's a lot of circular revenue here. A significant portion of AI revenue is likely circular. So, for example, Anthropic can commit billions to, or I'm sorry, Amazon could commit billions to Anthropic, or, you know, whatever, just using names. But let's say Amazon says, okay, Anthropic, we're going to commit quote-unquote billions to you, and they release a press release, Amazon commits billions to Anthropic. A lot of times that support is structured as cloud compute credits, not actual cash. And then Anthropic uses those credits to rent AWS servers, Amazon books that activity as AWS revenue, and Anthropic gets to benefit with its enterprise value because look at all this compute they just added, so we've got trajectory. So they're calling this a circular revenue. Now, looking at OpenAI, OpenAI is, in their own internal documents, on track to burn a staggering amount of cash through 2030. So OpenAI needs to build a business on the scale of Apple's original iPhone ecosystem from scratch in under 5 years in order to get to the money that they need to pay off their infra and make profit. So if they create models that are genuinely going to replace white-collar jobs across major industries, then this spending looks legitimate and they're going to make trillions of dollars and this IPO will look obvious in hindsight. That's going to just be the way it is. But if they hit some sort of scaling laws, diminishing returns, and they don't quite get to the point where they can replace white-collar jobs in the next 5 years, the market is going to, they're going to punish them for that. In the private world, they can go get more VC funding. They can keep burning. That's not how it's going to work in the public market. They are going to have to be responsible for that. Now, let's talk one more time here about Anthropic. To support roughly, let's say, a $965 billion post-IPO valuation, what would be a normal tech multiple of 25x earnings, which if you can believe is a little low for an AI company, but let's go with the low numbers here. Anthropic would need to produce around $38 billion to $40 billion in annual net income, not revenue, profit. $40 billion in profit. That's a key distinction. Anthropic does not just need to become a successful AI company. It needs to become one of the most profitable technology companies that exists on Earth for this bet to play out. Now, xAI, the third IPO, which might actually be the first one to go, it's harder to analyze because it's been brought into X and Starlink and all of that makes money. X has subscriptions. Starlink makes revenue for X and xAI. So it's murky in there because they can actually use the cash generated from the real Starlink business to help cover some of their costs for a while. But where xAI stands out from the other two is that xAI took on traditional bank debt with a high interest rate from Morgan Stanley. So they have a high interest rate loan. Instead of like getting private funding like the other blokes have done, Musk took some of his money from an actual bank. So from what I can tell, xAI needs to turn its API services and its super Grok services into a $10 billion per year profit engine. And they need to do that within a few years in order to become profitable and pay off that loan. So they'll be able to use Starlink and SpaceX and X subscriptions to subsidize their AI infra for a while. But they've got to get to around, and for my math, over $10 billion per year in profit in order to make this bet pay off. And if all three of these companies come to market around the same time, which they seemingly are trying to do within, you know, a 6 to 9 month window, the real story here is this is the largest liquidity extraction event in the history of markets. That's the story. And Wall Street is expecting these three companies combined to generate roughly $90 billion to $100 billion in pure annual net profit by 2030. So that requires the trio to collectively match the current annual profitability of Microsoft within just 5 years. Within 5 years. That's never been done.
So let's talk about productivity and whether you really see a productivity boost from AI. If I were being optimistic, I'd say, look, the last tech trades we got excited about were around social media and the Internet of Things. And we got excited enough about those. And did they really ever threaten to deliver a productivity boom? But maybe AI really will. You're not a believer.
I do think there's a productivity boom from AI, but it's how big of one. We're pricing an extraordinary one. We're pricing that, you know, these companies are all going to make an extraordinary amount of profit in the same overlapping sector, like Anthropic, you know, ChatGPT, Gemini, whichever, xAI. They're all going to completely dominate this space. They're all going to take in a whole load of revenues from all these other industries, even though these industries don't make enough money, the projections to like pay all these companies, all those made of earnings. And there's a real productivity boom, but how much of one and how quickly is it coming through? It's really hard to define. I think it's the key question. question. And when do we going to get that answer? And because that's the kind of earnings rug pull at some point. I think at the moment, you know, there's real earnings being made there, but it's the projections going out that really kind of worry me. So
the other thing about those projections is if you are really going to get to the market valuations they need, that you're going to be, you really truly will be disrupting jobs. You truly will be. And that would have an impact on the economy, which would have an impact on the market, which would hurt their revenue. So that's one trap. And that is going to suck a lot of liquidity out of the market. And it's just going to be something we got to ride through. But then there's another dynamic here that could derail the entire thing. So right now, there's a lot of will they or won't they talk around the rates. The effective Fed fund rate from the Fed in the U.S. is like around 3.5, 3.75% right now. If we had a sudden inflation spike, I don't know, maybe an energy shock or something like that, and the Fed did come out and hike rates, which seems like a long shot to me, but has a 39% chance on Polymarket right now, an escalating interest rate environment would trigger major financial traps for these AI companies. It would compress their tech multiples from, like, say, around 25 or 30x, which is generous, but kind of what they're going for, to probably a 15x. So you would go from a 30x multiple to a 15x multiple. OpenAI's needed annual net profit to sustain that $1 trillion valuation, it doesn't stay at just around $40 billion, $39 billion that they have to get. You know, like that, which is crazy already, a net profit of around $40 billion. If rates start going up, it doubles instantly. They need $80 billion because of all the debt. They have to get $80 billion in net profit if rates go up. They go from $39, $40 billion requirement to $80 billion. And the $40 is already almost impossible to do. They'd have to create Apple's iPhone business in 5 years in order to get to that. And if the rates go up, it doubles. A rate hike essentially moves the goalpost twice as far away. It's just what it is. It makes their five-year targets mathematically impossible. It truly does. And the data center builds take a complete hit here because building data centers requires an unbelievable amount of real physical debt. And there's land involved. There's loans for all the material. Every fraction of a percentage point the Fed adds translates to hundreds of millions of dollars in extra interest payments for these labs. Just little tweaks upwards, just little tweaks. And it would impact XAI the hardest because they already carry $5 billion of traditional bank debt from Morgan Stanley. And higher rates would actively bleed from their operational cash flow and their ability to invest in AI, and they'd have to pay more in interest. So here we are on the cusp of will they or won't they? While we have a possible energy situation also developing.
And of course, why is that? Why do they care? It's in order to win more votes. The midterm elections are right around the corner. Now, you have to understand that this drop right here.
Now, that's not the right clip. Sorry, this is the right clip.
This morning's release of core PCE, the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, showed prices rose at an annual rate of 3.3% in April, a nearly three-year high. Let's bring in Joe Livornia. He most recently served as Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's economic counselor. Joe, great to have you with us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Why at least 100 basis points?
Because if you look at core inflation from where it was before we attacked Iran, it's going to be up at least 100 basis points. So in simple, basic math, your real interest rate has collapsed 100. You'd want to offset that by raising the funds rate at least by that amount.
Uh-oh.
Of course, as you said at the highlight at the beginning of the show, these equity averages are at all-time highs. The credit spreads are super tight. The dollar is, you know, high, but not excessively high. There's no tightening of financial conditions. And the inflation numbers, the 3 and 6 month change, show inflation moving up towards 4%. So what's going to force that back to 2%? It won't happen magically.
Yeah, but you can't. I mean, I just can't imagine they're going to do a rate hike. I think what you do instead is you come up with a new way to calculate inflation. Oh, a new Fed standard. The new golden standard. And look at that. Wouldn't you know it? Inflation is just around where we wanted it. I mean, maybe. Okay, so that clip I was playing there for a second, I want to set that up because it comes in hot. Because a big portion of this, which is going to force the Fed's hand, is going to continue to put downward pressure on Bitcoin, is this prolonged conflict with Iran. It's going to have second-order effects on the energy market. Data centers are effectively massive factories that turn electricity into intelligence, so it's going to have an impact on the AI pump. Power rates are already going up. These companies are trying to commit to covering energy cost increases. Part of the reason we're not fully feeling the impact of this, though, and why it's still sort of like, well, it depends on how long things go, and we're just sort of in this sort of weird purgatory state, is because Western governments have been releasing oil from their strategic reserves. And so in this clip that I'm going to play, that we started there for a second, this is from the Clear Value Tax YouTube channel. And what he notes is that the U.S. seems to be once again releasing massive amounts of oil. The chart has that he has up on the screen shows us that levels are down to like the mid-80s. So we haven't been that low since the mid-80s, which, of course, was shortly after we had dumped a bunch for the oil crunch in the late 70s and mid-70s, and then even issues in the 80s as well. So we were historically low at that point, and that's where we're at once again. And he suggests in this clip that it is likely to be partly politically motivated.
And of course, why is that? Why do they care? It's in order to win more votes. The midterm elections are right around the corner. Now, you have to understand that this drop right here, like this is just starting and it's going fast. The most recent week's data shows a release of 9.1 million barrels. And that's just short of the all-time high release set the prior week. And look, it's not like we have the luxury of a huge stockpile anymore. We had 725 million barrels near the highs. Now we're down to 365 million barrels as of May 22nd, and it's dropping fast. I mean, just take a look at where we are compared to previous periods. 365 million barrels, that is historically low. And again, it's falling fast. So yes, this is getting concerning. But you know what's a little bit wild, at least to me? We're releasing a massive amount of oil from our emergency oil reserves, right? But at the same time, we're exporting a record amount of oil to Europe and Asia. Like, why are we not protecting our emergency oil reserves? But you know what? I'm going to answer my own question. It's probably because our allies are very upset with us. And this is the least that we can do for them in order for our allies not to turn on us, at least not for now.
But okay, all right. So he's probably right there. So let's bring all this together. The Western governments are quickly draining our oil reserves, which removes future optionality, obviously. The energy market could easily spiral out of control, which could slam the stock market. It could potentially rug these AI IPOs as they're trying to launch, which would collapse the GDP of the United States and all other Western governments. So we find ourselves in a classic systemic trap. Draining resources remove strategic flexibility. Energy spikes feed inflation. The market pulls back, the growth engine IPOs stall, and the broader economy stalls with them. And I think Bitcoin is sniffing this risk out right now. Now, I'm not saying this is what's going to happen. I am saying this is a risk. And even if this particular scenario doesn't play out and we get into 2027 and through these IPOs, the vacuuming of liquidity out of the market is just going to be monstrous. All right, so the question is, Chris, if the math is so obvious, why are people selling their Bitcoin to buy AI stocks? We see it in the charts, especially in the ETFs, for almost 12 weeks straight. People are selling their iBit and whatever and rotating into AI stocks. Well, I'd argue because some of the largest holders out there, I think, and I've warned you guys about this, I think this whole Bitcoin is digital gold has bit us in the rear, and it no longer is what people consider working. They think, look, if it was digital gold, then it should be up right now. You know, I think this, I thought about this early on, and I thought this digital gold narrative could bite us. Here's the clip that made me think a little bit more about this.
Parker, she's a strategic advisor at RWA.xyz. Emily, it's good to see you. And I note that Tom Lee was asked this question on our air earlier today, and his defense was, this is what always happens during crypto winters, and he calls them rage quitters.
Yes, I mean, people have been pivoting from crypto to AI for a while. Here's the thing. Bitcoin is a sentiment-driven narrative, and it's a sentiment-driven asset, and it's a narrative-driven asset. And in terms of sentiment, you just have people excited about other things right now. They're excited about AI, and they're excited about the stock market, which is largely driven by AI. There's also one really important difference between Bitcoin and AI, which is that I'm sure you've seen there's a lot of very smart people who still say, I don't understand how Bitcoin works. I don't understand what it does. And like, not that many people understand how AI works, but they don't have to because they're actually using it. It touches their daily lives.
I actually think there is something to that. The benefits of Bitcoin are a lot more abstract, just like benefits of gold. I mean, think about how long gold has been around. The fact that it hasn't been aped into by more people shows you that the average person doesn't get the benefit of a store of value generally. But they can go use ChatGPT and get a recipe and they get that benefit.
I think Mark Cuban was talking about the narrative problem. You know, as I said, Bitcoin's a narrative-driven asset. It came into the world to be this unique asset that was independent of banks and governments. But over the past few years, much of what's powered Bitcoin's rise has been Wall Street or the U.S. government. And it just doesn't really make sense as a story. And it's also the opposite of Bitcoin's origin story. So it's kind of losing what makes it unique.
What?
And I think for portfolio holders...
I don't even know how she gets there. I've heard this clip a couple times now, and I don't know how she gets there at all. It's a fundamental misunderstanding.
The idea was like, okay, Bitcoin is so unique, it can act as a hedge against the stock market. So you should have Bitcoin in your portfolio. But with stocks soaring and Bitcoin plunging, basically it's the opposite. It's almost like you want to have stocks in your portfolio to act as a hedge against Bitcoin.
Right? You know, they're never happy because they complain when Bitcoin is correlated to the NASDAQ or the S&P. They say it's risky. And then when Bitcoin decorrelates, well, then it's a failed experiment. It's no longer digital gold. Well, which one is it?
And I think, you know, I was talking to a few friends about a year and a half ago, there was this first kind of conflict between Iran and in the Middle East, and Bitcoin had sold off instead of rallying on that kind of along with the stock market. And they said, wait a minute, those correlations aren't what I was promised, and saw that as an opportunity to sell. It was fortuitous in that case. What would your message be to those who are still in it? I mean, do they need to sell and get out at 67 and go put the capital into something that's actually going to grow over time and has a proven track record?
Oh, it hurts. It's like they all have AI-itis that's affected their memory. Has that host forgotten that Bitcoin has been the best performing asset for 10 years and that we are in an AI extreme bubble that is an anomaly? It's incredible. And since when did anybody say you should buy Bitcoin and expect to sell it within a year and make a profit? When has that ever been the promise? Ever? This is absolutely bonkers. And first of all, narrative almost always follows price, which is the opposite of what they're saying. It's embarrassing for them. But not every fat cat investor is this dumb. Speaking of SpaceX, thanks to their IPO filings, we actually learned that they have been sitting on a little stack of Bitcoin.
According to an SEC filing on Wednesday, Elon Musk's SpaceX holds more than twice as much Bitcoin as previously estimated. Here to break it all down with us is Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow, co-host of Bloomberg Technology. Ed, Elon Musk's view on Bitcoin have swung between endorsement to skepticism. Where does it stand right now?
Yeah, there's a big difference in the SpaceX story between the what and why of these Bitcoin holdings. So as of that regulatory filing, they hold 18,712 Bitcoin, and the average purchase price over the history of the holdings is like $35,000 per token. So Bitcoin costs them about $661 million to acquire. The value of the holdings is $1.3 billion. And like the way that SpaceX would tell it is, what are they treating this as? Basically, it's held as a treasury reserve asset, just in the way that cash or bonds would be, but by a custodian third party. Mm-hmm. That's very different to saying, like, well, what is Elon Musk's attitude to it? You don't get that from the filing itself. Although I guess if you guys want to have some fun, this is Bloomberg Crypto.
Yeah.
We could come up with some ideas.
Well, you know, they completely missed the signal here. The signal is that private companies have been stacking Bitcoin for a while, but they don't have to tell anyone. And then we find out when they try to go public. And SpaceX, 18,000 is a nice little stack that they acquired in the 30s. So they're doing just fine. I'm pretty impressed. We started the week, speaking of Bitcoin strategies, learning that Sailor Strategy sold 32 Bitcoin. That's 0.0038% of their 843,738 Bitcoin stack. And I think this sale is really about two things. I think it's interesting that people are really freaking out in some areas. But being that the stock, I think what Strategy was maybe seen as, especially in the MSTR days, was the stock that just holds Bitcoin. And that if you bought MSTR, you were getting proxy exposure to Bitcoin. That's not the product anymore. That has not been the product for a bit. And we'll talk about that in a second. The other thing that's kind of going on under the surface here is you might recall Strategy met all the criteria for S&P 500 inclusion multiple times. Market cap, liquidity, 4 consecutive profitable quarters. But the S&P Index Committee used their quote-unquote discretionary power to reject them anyway. You might also remember I covered the MSCI Index threatening to kick out these Bitcoin treasury companies out of the index. And their index is used by trillions of dollars worth of ETFs. I mean, they were floating this idea that any Bitcoin business that had 50% or more of its total assets in Bitcoin would be excluded from the index. Now, MSCI ultimately decided to not do that. But they kind of, if you remember, they left the door open back in February. They said, well, we might do something in the future. So with that in mind, listen to this clip of Saylor. This was shortly after they announced on their earnings calls before the Bitcoin sale that, you know, he was going into more detail about why they might sell Bitcoin.
But there's been a bit of confusion in the market about where the dividends come from. You know, how do we pay the dividend? And for most of the history of the instrument, we sold common equity, MSTR equity, to pay the dividend. MSTR equity is a derivative of Bitcoin. It normally trades at a premium to Bitcoin. And so we were selling a Bitcoin derivative. But some people worried that we wouldn't be able to sell the equity in the future. And then there are short narratives that we have to sell the equity. And then there are other narratives that the company won't sell its Bitcoin. And that kind of metastasized to, well, if they're not going to sell their Bitcoin, it must not have any value and they can never sell it. And if they can't sell it, then we can't count the Bitcoin as an asset on the balance sheet. So if you had $65 billion worth of something and people wanted to value it at zero, it's not very good, right? We don't want the credit rating agencies to think the company has $0 of assets. We want the credit rating agencies to think we have $65 billion of assets.
And ironically, one of the ways to do that is to sell the Bitcoin. This is the way it is. Well, Saylor seems to kind of always be reinventing his strategy. I feel like Adam Back's treasury company is gearing up to be a direct competitor and kind of honing in on their overall play.
Now, personally, I'm not in a hurry for government organizations to buy Bitcoin because, as the saying goes, everybody buys Bitcoin at the price they deserve. And it's okay to me if they buy at a higher price, basically.
Mm-hmm. How does BSTR play into that then?
Yeah, so BSTR is another MicroStrategy competitor. I'm the CEO and my co-founder, Sean Bill, is the CIO, and then some other early Bitcoin investors behind that. And the differentiator for BSTR, which we've put into the filed documents, now this is still waiting regulator approval, but so what I can talk about what's in the filed documents, of course. And there we have explained that we intend to be active, so to seek a return on Bitcoin using fund management strategies, whereas many of the treasury companies are effectively relying on cold storage and the capital markets mechanisms. So we aim to use both approaches simultaneously.
Oh man, they did it. They did it. They got me to talk about the Clarity Act again. What a soap opera this thing has become. And trust me, it took Jamie Dimon running his mouth to get me to talk about it this week. I wanted to take a break. But here's Jamie Dimon on Fox Business. Jamie, he's pissed off that the Clarity Act is making progress.
So are you happy with the way the Clarity Act is turning out?
No. No, because it allows them to effectively pay interest on deposits, stable coins or something like that, without the protection that they should have. And it doesn't do anything for AML/BSA. It has almost no legal protections. So no, the banks will not accept it that way.
That is legitimately not a true statement. I don't really give a crap about the Clarity Act, but the one thing about the Clarity Act is it's loaded with surveillance and other mechanics to monitor financial transactions. Loaded.
The ABA, the small banks, the credit unions, it's not just the big guys. I'm not worried about stablecoin, but if it happened, I'm telling you, I would have nothing to do with it and it would eventually blow up on its own. Okay, but that's my personal thing, but I do understand the concern of all the other banks. So,
well, the markup is coming. I mean, what are you going to do about it?
It is. We'll fight it. If we lose, we lose and we'll live.
Okay.
But it will be fought. This will not be, no one's going to bow down to this guy, okay, or that company. And but he's the only one.
Yeah.
And he's spending hundreds of millions of dollars in Washington, this thing.
Okay? He said he's representing the whole
industry. He's full of shit.
Martha doesn't really know how to handle that. First of all, you know, it's not all Brian. I mean, he is sort of the front man, but it's not all
Washington,
Brian.
This thing.
Okay? He said he's representing the whole
industry. He's full of shit.
Well, we're going to watch that one.
Yeah, we are.
So yesterday afternoon, two things happened. The Blockchain Association sent a letter to Senate Majority Leader Thune and Senate Democratic Leader Schumer, signed by 160 former national security intelligence and law enforcement professionals in support of the Clarity Act. And the second thing that happened yesterday, the Clarity Act was added to the Senate legislative calendar. It is now making it eligible for full Senate consideration. So the letter makes it clear how great the Clarity Act is for crackdowns. In fact, it really underscores the entire basis for the letter is how it gives them better surveillance over crypto, DeFi, stablecoins, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, Bitcoin is being left out of it. But that is the big takeaway. And that's your Clarity Drama update. All right, now I want to cover one of the most misunderstood, misreported Bitcoin stories of the week. You may have heard it. Did the U.S. seize Iran's Bitcoin? This really got the rounds in just hours, and it was all kicked off by comments that were made by your buddy, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
It's, have at it. So, you know, we've frozen Iranian bank accounts.
After they started getting bombed by Iran.
Yes, but it was a big strategic
big mistake.
Failure on the financial side.
And you jumped right in.
And we jumped right in. And you know, they've been very good partners. I believe that we have seized about $1 billion of their crypto. And
you know, just outright seized it.
Just outright grabbed the wallets. Some of them may be like typing in right now and realize they might not have realized that their wallet had been grabbed. And you know, we are working with our allies all over Europe to grab, you know, villas and houses and properties. You know, this is money that's stolen from the Iranian people.
But you've frozen the offshore accounts. I mean, people may not understand that the Revolutionary Guard, they own so many of the businesses. They've been stealing money from the Iranian people.
So I think with all the headlines that Iran is going to have a straight insurance policy paid in Bitcoin, people thought that Scott was talking about Bitcoin and they just assumed that. But he was talking about stablecoins. And you might have even noticed in there, he says they've been great partners. He's probably referring to Tether there. Speaking of Bessent, though, just moments ago, as I was sitting down to record the show, he was in a Senate testimony and the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve came up. The ghost of the Strategic Reserve lived.
What we are experiencing right now, Danny.
Sorry, I don't know why my play. Oh, I do know why. I'm hitting the wrong button. All right. Here's the ghost of the Strategic Reserve. I'll try to remember to hit the right button.
And part of that is our digital assets initiative. The Strategic Bitcoin Reserve is something. This is new technology. This is new ground. We are proceeding with all deliberate speed.
Yeah.
And we are making sure that as we are doing this, in this complicated process, that we use best practices and things will be durable for the future. I look forward to working with you and your team on that.
Absolutely.
And I look forward to the Clarity Act being passed this summer.
Oh, getting excited there about the Clarity Act. We'll see Bitcoin Strategic Reserve coming up again. I think that's kind of interesting. The clip I was spoiling yet again, 2 for 2, I guess, this week. It really helped me put it into perspective just what an information arbitrage we are living through with Bitcoin. And it's going to get even more stark as people just pile in to the IPOs. And it's just obvious to me because like people were like looking around in the room when Scott there said the Strategic Reserve was still on the table and people talking about Bitcoin just not living up to its original promise and other billionaires that have been bailing on it recently. We are just so obviously in an information arbitrage. And I think the issue is people, Bitcoin's positive aspects are really abstract, like inflation's negative aspects are really abstract. You know what I mean? It's hard for people to wrap their head around it. And so James Lavish was on What Bitcoin Did. And the way he lays it out, I actually think this, if you want to call it information arbitrage, is actually, It's pretty understandable.
What we are experiencing right now, Danny, is an information or a knowledge arbitrage.
Yeah.
And so people just do not yet understand how Bitcoin is different and why it is the ultimate store of value and the ultimate debasement asset. They just don't understand it yet. There's a lot of confusion. There, you know, the mainstream media puts out confusing and hit pieces about it all the time. They commingle it with all the other cryptocurrencies and they just call them all the same thing. And so I have friends who say, oh yeah, I own that. I own Bitcoin. I own the Solana one. And it's like, yeah, they just don't get it. And it's okay. It's not their fault. They're just not interested in doing the research themselves. And they're listening to mainstream media and getting their news off of Facebook or their research off of Facebook. They're just not getting it. And so there is an information arbitrage that you and I are experiencing right now. It feels bad and it makes you feel like, am I an idiot? Am I just stupid that I'm, how early am I here? And the answer is you're still pretty early because I think that Bitcoin is going to trade above $1 million in early 2030s. 2032, 2033, I would be very surprised if we're not touching $1 million Bitcoin. That's me. That's my thesis. That's where I believe this thing is going. But I also believe that part of that is that arbitrage, that knowledge arbitrage will close. And as that does, you know, you're going to have the Harvards and the Yales and the University of Texas and the CalPERS and the Texas teachers and every pension and fire fund out there taking positions in Bitcoin as a core asset. And when they do that, that's when that knowledge begins to really spread. And people are like, oh, yeah. So Bitcoin is different. Okay, so Bitcoin is different. It's not just this moonshot thing. It's digital gold. Okay, then I should probably own some. And funny enough is I think that that's going to be a much healthier rise for Bitcoin in price and a much more stable rise. It's not going to be this massive volatile thing. It's going to be like people are, oh, I get it. Okay, I get it. Oh, okay. I understand now. I understand. I understand how it's different. And then we'll feel vindicated and, you know, we'll look like we're 143 years old when we're just in our 50s or in your case, 30s.
All right. So let me know, do you think Bitcoin is going to get to $1 million or over $1 million by 2032? That's what James was saying there. And I've been thinking about that. That's often been sort of my mental benchmark, my target, if you will, a soft target of expectation. But it's only 6 years away. In the last 5 years or so, we've been all over the place. So do you think by 2032 we'll be over $1 million? Boost in. Tell me what you think. You know I want to hear it. You can support the show just by doing what you do. If you want to buy sats on River, I got a link in the show notes. It's one of the best ways to buy sats in the U.S. Stack the sats over the summer. If you want to stack sats and go directly to your own wallet, Bitcoin Well. All about automatic self-custody. They don't have a wallet. You host it. It's time to spend your sats. The Bitcoin Company. You go from Lightning sats to gift card in seconds. You can log in with the Lightning Network. The only thing they do is Bitcoin. The Fold card lets you passively stack those sats, which, if it's on discount, you're stacking more sats. And they have the new credit card, too, where you can get up to as much as 4% sats back. Then, Salt Lending. You can get a Bitcoin-backed loan with liquidation protection from Salt Lending, so that way you don't have to sell your Bitcoin to get access to liquidity. Although, I will say, you want to be pretty careful. You want to be pretty careful these days. That's just some of the ways to support the show by doing what you do. And we do have some boosts.
And now it is time for Le Boost.
Oh, my goodness. Coming in at the last minute, Derivation Dinga saving the show, although I don't have it in the totals. It is our baller boost, so I will at least read it. But it's coming in live as I'm recording with 44,444 Satoshis.
This old duck still got it.
Great show as usual. Thanks for the value. Even if Bitcoin is flat for another quarter or two, tons of great work have been happening. It gives us plebs just more time to DCA at these super low prices. That is a very positive attitude. And I agree, Derivation Dingus. Thank you for being our baller booster, sir, at 44,444 sats. Appreciate you. Coming in at 13,300 satoshis, it's MDS. Well, my last boost was actually a pocket boost, but the pocket it knows well. Why don't you have all the sats in my wallet? This is my last standing. This is the last standing Pure Signal Bitcoin podcast, IMO. The bias and conflicting incentives are everywhere else. Appreciating the value for value model more than ever. Grateful you're still beaming this work to the world. Well, thank you very much. Thanks, MDS. I appreciate the recognition there of the value for value. Thanks for returning some. And our last boost, if you can believe it, comes from Adversary 17. Adversaries writes, I used to run both knots and core, but I only run core now. Just not a fan of property seizure in general. Mm-hmm.
Make it so.
That's just it right there. That's just it right there. Just not a fan of that. It just also it makes the network very small, in my opinion. It makes the network very, very small in a new kind of way. We're always worried about Bitcoin mining centralization, but I guess we don't worry about just a few small groups controlling Bitcoin knots, I guess. All right, I'm updating my totals as fast as I can, you know, being a big old math guy as I am. With the live boost coming in here, let's total it all up. So we had five of you stream sats. That doesn't seem right. Did something happen technically with this episode? I got to check what happened. This doesn't seem right at all. Five of you stream sats stacking 3,515 sats. Holy crap, that's really low. With a grand total of six boosters, which we stacked thanks to our big old baller boost from Derivation Dingus, we stacked a grand total of this episode of 74,354 sats. So that's pretty low. And I would normally, you know, I would normally be disappointed in that. However, two things, maybe three. Now I'm almost wondering when I see those low streaming counts if there was a technical issue with a node or something like that. But the other thing is last week was a blowout. We had over 700,000 sats. LUP had a great week and the launch had a great week. So the audience support has been showing up and, you know, Satoshis, they're limited. So I'm not actually that disappointed, even though the hourly rate that works out to, the 74,000 sat works out to, is we won't go there. We're not even going to go there. Because I know you guys are still out there. I know you'll step it up. And I know you have been extremely generous recently. So I'm not too worried about it. If you would like to help make next week's episode do a little better, I think these last two episodes have been very high signal. You can boost with Fountain FM or get yourself AlbiHub. And then you can boost with a whole bunch of podcasting 2.0 apps. This here is a value for value podcast. No advertiser. So you boost in, keeps the show going. That's how it all works. Thank you, everybody who supports the show, with a boost or a membership. You know, if anybody recognizes that song, too, you ought to boost in and tell me where that came from. All right, let's have some fun in the update section. You know, I have been bracing for a summer of stacking. The orange summer of BOG, a slow dwindle as the IPOs vampire us all. But two things. Usually when you're that certain about a market, that's when things change. And then the other constant of the universe is when you get a good Cramer crash out, it might be time to reconsider your stance. And ladies and gentlemen, I present you a banger.
I do know that, again, the faith of the American people shocked. Just shocked. I mean, I think that crypto, I mean, I sold all my crypto. I announced everything on TV, what I did with crypto. But I would not touch crypto in a million years because I wouldn't trust the deposit bank.
And you're making no distinction between centralized, decentralized.
They fought regulation. They didn't want regulation. And you don't have regulation. So if you have your money in any of those, I'm not calling you an idiot. I'm just saying you're using a lot of blind faith. And I like to have my money at JP Morgan. And I check on Monday to see whether my balance is there. It's there. It feels good. try getting your money out. When I had money, I'm not going to mention the firm that I had my money in, but it was a fight to get the money out. A fight. And I think that everybody who owns these various coins, Solana, Litecoin, I do think you're an idiot. Okay? I did not go to college to get stupid.
Did he call it corns? Now you tell me, is that clip fake news? I saw that getting submitted around. I feel like I've seen that crash out before. I submit it for your consideration, though. This next story, well, what's great about this clip is it's not about Bitcoin at all. And yet, in some ways, it's totally about Bitcoin.
I get to some breaking news now back here in the U.S. A former CIA senior officer is accused of secretly stashing 300 gold bars in his house that he brushed off as work-related expenses, according to court documents, and two people familiar with his employment history. Julia Ainsley is joining us now at this exclusive reporting. Sorry, Julia. What?
I know. Hallie, when I first heard this tip, I didn't think it was real. And then the court documents spelled out that there was a man who was an employee of a government agency that was found with $40 million worth of gold bars in his home. If you're wondering how many gold bars that is, the court document says it's about 308. What my team here at NBC News, Dan DeLuce and Gary Grumbach, and I found is that that man was not just an employee of any agency. He was a high-level official with top-secret clearance in the CIA, and that he not only lied about what he was doing with this money, but that allegedly he also lied about his background, said that he graduated from a college he did not attend, that he went to a graduate school he did not attend.
Man, that guy sounds like a wildcat. I guess he also has something like 34 high-end watches. But cryptos, totally. Stablecoins are totally the concern. Totally. So this week I was watching CNBC, so you don't have to. And there I was going about my biz, and totally always a Bitcoin maxi, Anthony Pompliano, came on. And he actually had a really good segment. I was like, oh, good job there, Pomp. Good job. Maybe I'll clip that. The reaction, however, that I noticed online about an hour or two later was nasty. Someone had taken something he said, which was Bitcoin is a dog with fleas, focused just on that and put it out on blast on social media. So I thought the fair thing to do, because I think he was actually making a decent point and wasn't actually slamming Bitcoin, would be to play the entire clip in its full context. So this is Anthony Pompliano, or AKA your buddy Pomp. And this is him on CNBC yesterday.
What's going on with this dog of an asset?
He said Bitcoin is dog with fleas. That's what he said.
All right, I got a great stat for you guys. So if you go back on 1 year timeline, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, all the way to 10 years.
Yep.
Every single year on that timeline, gold has outperformed the S&P. And why is that important? Because if you go back over a 5 or 10 year time frame, Bitcoin and gold on the compound annual growth rate has been significantly outperforming. Now, the reason I bring that up is because we usually think of gold is not being super volatile, and we think of Bitcoin as being very, very volatile. Mm-hmm. But over these long time periods, what we find is that these assets actually do better than what are supposed to be the productive stocks. Now, that doesn't make investors feel good because Bitcoin hasn't been doing very well over the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so what I think people have to realize is that while AI stocks are flying and everyone is chasing momentum and it's hitting all-time highs, usually the thing that you want to be buying is the thing that's out of favor that's going to come back into favor. And so the big question is, if you think about Bitcoin, is the U.S. government going to stop printing money? If they do not start printing money, which I don't think they're going to stop, that means that Bitcoin at some point in the future is going to be back. It'll be the pretty girl at the bar again.
That's the catalyst.
Yeah, they're always looking for the catalyst. All right, well, let's end up here with a little, before we totally wrap, I just got to give you a little dose of bullish Tom Lee. You know, old Tom Lee, whose Bitmine ETH is now down $8.9 billion, on 5,416,901 ETH. But Tom Lee, he's still feeling the pamp. He thinks it's coming. It's just a matter of time. It's just been slightly delayed, he says.
So I think there are what I call, quote, rage quitting people selling here as if something is wrong. I mean,
he's actually responding and referring to Mark Cuban here.
One, I think that's what always happens at the end of crypto winter. You know, if someone asks me, is the thesis for Bitcoin or Ethereum broken? You know, it's absolutely not, because one, the more work we do, and we're hearing it from founders like Palantir, Bitcoin and Ethereum are really the future of money, because mass and compute, or compute and energy, however Elon puts it, really are what's scarce. And you're going to need to control agent systems. And as AI systems evolve, right, we're now talking about using commerce and operating websites.
you need decentralized identity and verification. That's really what crypto does.
What?
And we know Wall Street wants to go towards tokenization. It's a vast improvement in efficiency of actually how money moves, and it's an innovation. Well, that only happens on Bitcoin and Ethereum and other smart contracts. So the future isn't changed, but the spotlight today is, of course, on semis, memory, starting on software. But as people focus downstream into the future, that's really, I think, when the bid comes for Bitcoin and Ethereum.
Okay, so when people focus downstream on the future, Tom says that's when the bid comes. So what he's referring to when he says this is he believes that there's the two catalysts are going to be tokenization of all kinds of assets. And Tom's a big believer, and I'm not. He's a big believer that agents are going to be transacting on an ETH chain or maybe in sats.
Because when you talk about stocks, it was so easy for you. You did it. $10 times four, that's, you know, $40, put a multiple on, that's 800 points. Why do you even try with Bitcoin or Ethereum? What's your comparable analysis to be able to come up with anything to make predictions about Bitcoin or Ethereum? There's nothing that you can base it on, Tom, except maybe a psychology or sentiment or something.
Yeah, well, actually, market sentiment plays a huge role because it's sort of essentially risk premia, but...
Before Tom continues, it's just interesting that even Joe there doesn't seem to understand that the best money ever created by humanity has utility, and that utility gives it value as well, right? It's the hardest money ever created. It's refined, prescription-grade money. It's the ultimate utility for money, and that is valuable right there. But Tom has some other points.
There are two proven ways to value crypto. One, of course, is just network usage, because wallets and activity per wallet still explain, like, even now, 87% of the rise of Bitcoin. So as long as more people use it and they're transacting it, the value of Bitcoin should go up. It's a network effect. And the second is the umbrella value of gold. You know, gold at when it hits 5,000, if Bitcoin had the same network value as gold, and gold is not as scarce as Bitcoin, that would put Bitcoin at around 2 million.
So that's always interesting. But I want to flip the script here as we wrap up. Just think about it this way. Over the past 12 months, the AI boom has added roughly $19 trillion in new market cap to the top 50 public equities. That's 13 times Bitcoin's total market cap. This CapEx cycle is vacuuming up liquidity like nothing we've ever seen and getting all the attention, getting all the headlines. So that really creates this institutional risk appetite that just isn't there for something like Bitcoin right now. I think the real surprise is that Bitcoin hasn't been weaker. Really. $19 trillion in new market cap? 13x Bitcoin's total market size? I think the real surprise is that Bitcoin has been this resilient in general. I think it's absorbing one of the largest capital rotations in market history. And it's actually still standing. That's impressive. Let's check in on the state of the network before I get out of here. We are wrapping up at block height 952,247. That makes our current Bitcoin price to US dollar $65,990, putting our sats per dollar 1,515, making our decline from the all-time high 47.7%. How low can we go? Well, we can go to 70. We can go further. All-time high 239 days ago. Retarget date now June 12th. With a difficulty downward adjustment of a major 9.8% downwards adjustment, we may see that turnaround. There are 28,185 reachable nodes on the network, and we are down almost 12%, 11.9% in the last 7 days, and I don't care. It's a summer of stack, and we continue to stack right along. The truth is, the fundamentals of the Bitcoin network, they're doing great. They really are. It's watching the network adjust and balance this stuff out is always really impressive. And so, I like that term, summer of stack. I think it was Mari that came up with that. I've seen Summer of Stack going around. I like it. Links to what I talked about today at thisweekinbitcoin.show. I apologize for some of the technical issues. I'm running a new control board that does some, you know, various things that I used to still have to learn or relabel buttons. So I apologize, but hopefully it was still enjoyable and insightful. I think there's some signal in here, and my goal is to give you a show that doesn't get distracted around the emotion, doesn't get distracted by the politics or the drama, but tries to find the signal in all of that so that way you can plan for yourself, your friends, your family, your business, whatever it might be. So you can let me know how I did there with a boost as well. And of course, I want to hear your thoughts if Bitcoin gets to a million by 2032-ish, boost in and let me know about that. Now, I'm going to leave you with a value for value track. If you boost in, 95% of your sats will go to our artists. And this week, it's from the Dorfels. It's been a while. And it's their track, What We Are. See you next week. Thanks for being here.
We were fuel on fire. We were bullets from a gun. We were rising higher, getting further from the sun. The lightning in the dark, though the moon shine brighter, they called us shooting stars. What we are isn't who we are. What we are is never who we are. Chasing flames, but there's ashes in our bed. Now I'm an empty bottle, so I drink to pass the time. You're a lonely heartbreak, you can't look me in the eye. What we are, is it who we are?